All right, ready?
Hit me.
Hello, BattleTech fans. Welcome to Renegade HPG. This is Travis, and today I'm excited to welcome Lauren Coleman to the podcast. Lauren is the owner of Catalyst Game Labs and current steward of the BattleTech license. For our conversation today, we're going to dive into some of Lauren's early history as a creator for the IP and explore his experiences with Catalyst Game Labs and bringing this world back into the spotlight within the gaming community. Lauren, thanks for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here. Very excited.
Definitely. Well, before we dive in, I did want to give a shout out to the Wolfnik guys because they had done a podcast with you in January. And so, you know, anybody listening, I encourage you to check that out after this one. I want to make sure that we're not kind of retreading a lot of the same stuff because I got tons of stuff I want to go over. If you want some more kind of story time and stuff, I definitely, recommend people swing over there as a compliment to this podcast. But Lauren, I wanted to, I love talking about creators. I love hearing about the creative process, kind of get that little history into BattleTech from the perspective of those creators. And for you, coming into BattleTech as a writer, I'd really like to hear about kind of those early experiences you had first as a contributor to the source books and then kind of, evolving into the novel side of things. But, to focus first on those source books specifically, I'm curious what that process is like because there's so many authors credited on those source books and you never know who's doing what within them. And I know that you spend a lot of time as a freelancer and that's kind of how you guys continue to kind of outsource a lot of your work, especially your writing work now. And what kind of insight you can give into what that is like and how you contribute and where the direction is coming and how you kind of bring your own vision into the universe through that medium.
Wow, there's a lot in there to unpack. Okay. Yeah, I got my start by, I met Sam Lewis at a writing, a writer's workshop. I didn't know who he was. A friend of mine, Greg Gordon, introduced us. Greg was a major writer at that point for doing game design. He was designing Earth Dawn for FASA, among other things. Met Sam Lewis. Sam invited me to just write a couple things up for BattleTech. And so he handed me off to Brian Nystol. Brian gave me an assignment. I did that. I did how to game master the current BattleTech RPG section. And Brian liked my writing. So Brian said, hey, how about there's this new idea we have called a field manual, about 80,000 words. Go write that for us. No, hardly any. It's like, it's just a deep dive on the Charles Combine, TONE, units, histories, people. It was wide open, complete Wild West for me. And I went from writing like a 10,000 word piece to an 80,000 word source book. And Brian threw me right in the deep end of the pool and then tied weights around my ankles. Very nice guy.
Awesome.
And it was great. I mean, I already knew BattleTech. I'd been reading it, had played it some, and so it was very exciting for me. And I did that, and that started my kind of like a rise at FASA because I pulled that off in pretty record time, and suddenly I was writing at least two source books a year at that point for FASA almost immediately. I could turn in stuff. I could write fast, hit deadlines. I could work with minimal supervision. And so they really gave me a lot of room to play. And I mean, I invented the format for the field manuals, just sitting there as I wrote, I discovered how to format what I wanted to say. And that became the format for all the field manuals thereafter. And so they gave me a lot of room. So I played a lot. I was able to put my own stamp on some of the people and events of the timeline. Made up a lot of background material that eventually showed up in later source books and novels. It was such a huge universe. I mean, there's no way to traffic cop at all. So they didn't even try. They trusted me not to go too far off the reservation, and we had a great time. So that's how I kind of started writing the source books. And I was like one of their premier, me, Chris Hartford, eventually Chris Trossen. We were doing, all of us were doing anywhere from one, two, even sometimes three source books in a year sometimes working together, sometimes not. Little stuff like Dragon Roar's campaign play, up to Force Man or field manuals and big chunks of other rule books. So it was great. And I started doing like fiction snippets in there, and that was helped me make my case for doing a Baltic novel. I met Donna Ippolito, the editor at Gen Con, my first Gen Con that next year. And she looked at some stuff I had written and said, hey, this is good stuff, but you're like a whole year out of date, at least a year, if not 2 years out of date. We are writing way past this era, because they were putting out the Twilight of the Clans at that point.
Okay.
So I was so far behind the curve as to where the storyline was being written. She said, this is good, but we can't use it. But I'll keep you in mind. And I think it was only like maybe a few months after Gen Con, she called me and said, someone just dropped their novel. They can't get it done. They punted. And we've got a hole in our schedule. Would you like to write a Baltic novel in the current timeline? It was basically set really close to Twilight of the Clans, but it would not be involved. It would be like back in the Inner Sphere, what's been going on. Yep. I said, well, of course I would like to do that. And she said, and we need it in 2 months. And can you do that? I said, of course I can do that. Hung up the phone and went, okay, now what do I do? Because I had no idea if I could write a novel in 2 months' time.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's how I got my first break in doing a novel. And then I called Brian, and Brian said, yeah, we want you to do this novel. Donna said, you're doing it. So here's the thing. You must do these seven things. And they were like all over the map. You know, make the Capella Confederation cool was number one on the list. I'm like, okay, come on. They've never been cool. I can do that. Yep. You know, show off some mercenaries, play with the periphery. You know, like he had all these weird touchstones. And I looked at that and went, okay, I see a way to do it, but I have to have a main character. I need a major character. I need Sun Tzu Lao to make this, tie this together. So Brian went to Mike Stackpole and said, can Lauren borrow Sun Tzu? And Mike said, let him borrow him and see what he does with him. And that was Double Blind.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that was my avenue into the industry. I had done a little work before then for like Mayfair Games. I think I wrote one thing for another company, I can't remember, Rolaids line, that is also made for games. But that's, you know, that was my big splash coming in. And I worked for FASA pretty much 90% was my work for the next several years was all FASA all the time. So that's how I came in.
I love that. So you traded, I gave you a lot to unpack, you gave me a lot to unpack. And so I got a lot of questions coming out of that.
Yeah.
The field manual first. And so when you're, I know it must have been a lot easier kind of in the early days writing those things because you don't have as much established lore going on that you got to go back and check and make sure you're not conflicting. And so from what you were saying, it sounds like that was early enough where there was a lot of stuff you were able to kind of just freely develop the universe. I'm curious how much time when you're writing something like that is spent in kind of going back and kind of double checking and researching what's been done before and what's already been established first, kind of moving it forward with your own storytelling.
Writers become instant experts. We know how to get the most out of the most information and the least amount of research because we just don't have time.
Yeah.
In this case, the biggest issue was knowing which units in the Combine were storied units. They had backstory somewhere else in the source books.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I had photocopies of the house books that Brian had given me and some other digital stuff. But it was hard because some of these units that were like, you know, the fourth Tossetti, the Sword of Light, the Genyosha, the Vagan, whatever Theodore's unit was. I mean, so I had to go read Heir of the Dragon just to talk about, you know, Theodore's, you know, regiment. And, you know, the Sword of Light appears in several source books. And I gleaned as much as I could, as fast as I could. There was no research team. There was no continuity checkers. It was me on the phone with Brian Nystol occasionally going, is there anything about the Arcab Legion I need to be aware of? He's like, nah, don't worry about it. Just go. You know, how about the Sword of Light? Oh, yeah, make sure you mention like this and this and this and just go.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of just, if we get it wrong, we'll deal with it later. Fortunately, I think I got most of it. You know, there were a few places where I had some maybe some overlap where I missed a bet, but mostly my quick research was pretty solid. And again, Brian's advice, because Brian knew the source books, he knew where to find the big references, and that assisted me a great deal. So it was wide open, but still, I was always cognizant of the fact that there was still a lot of history out there in the house books and the Succession Wars manuals and all the stuff that was out there that I had to go find, because I wanted to make sure. I didn't want a fan coming up to me at a convention going, "You said they were here and they were actually over here." And okay.
Yeah. And you're like, yeah. That's right. I'm curious, because there's a lot of books that are written from a future perspective, from Comstar, Word of Blake, whoever it might be, who's kind of the overseer faction at the time. And is there coordination from the staff, other than just kind of giving you guys kind of a way to maneuver around? Is there coordination in terms of what is more definitive than the other? If you're seeing something, you know, from that future perspective, is that kind of the go-to when you see conflicts versus what might be in a book from the perspective of the faction itself?
There's a lot of leeway we have in that, how we present the book. Like, you know, the field manuals, I believe, were presented as an internal document. And so I think on that one, we bypassed the Comstar's outside perspective where they were always commenting on things. Mm-hmm. We did it as a complete internal, true document. Every source book was different. We did source books that were completely deniable. Things that were like, you know, here's a source book, nothing of which may be true. Some of which probably is, we won't know for years. Mm-hmm. We will decide later. You know, that was the jihad books we did. Right. They were completely apocryphal. Is how we wrote that. That was by design, because we were still trying to get a handle on how long this was going to run. We were working without a net at that point. And so we had to have, everything had to be deniable, at least to some extent, so we could then backfill later with what was actually going on, because nobody knew. They say, write a source book. What's going on? We can't tell you. There's some fighting. Word of Blake's going crazy. There's some jumbled communications. Everything's deniable. Just write something. I'm like, okay. So you know, that kind of thing was, yeah, that's at that point, I think Catalyst was actually publishing, or we were, that was the very end of the FASTA era, beginning of, or FanPro era, beginning of Catalyst. Mm-hmm. But you know, along the way, every book is handled at what point of view, where in the timeline are we? What is the point of view on this book? Is there a second point of view? Like, hey, here's an internal document that's been found by the other factions that we can comment on from both sides. I mean, that's always a great thing to start with. Say, okay, where are we at? Who is doing the commenting? Who is actually putting it together? And that let us do some really creative stuff. And there was no master plan. Every book was looked at on its own to say, where does it make the most sense to set this and to write it from what point of view? That was book by book. And still, even today, that is really the way we still do it. We go with what makes the most sense for the book, because it's such a huge universe. Say, well, we want to do this very narrow book about the Draconis Combine, but you don't want to forget the Davians. So how about we have a Draconis Combine product that was stolen by the Davians so they can comment on it? That way we get two factions, and at least two factions in the book. You know, we do that all the time still to make sure we don't leave anybody out.
And kind of leveraging that into Double Blind, you know, I was able to go back and kind of reread that in Binding Force. So I definitely want to kind of focus on those two books and ask sure. questions on there. Leading into it, and you had time to touch on this before, but in my conversation with Sam Lewis, who has got to be one of the most fun podcast guests that I've had. We've had him on multiple times.
Sam is awesome.
But he had dropped a little nugget in that kind of on his way out from FASA, he had kind of like giddily dropped the bomb that Leo is going to become a dominant force, make it happen, and then ran away with a smile on his face. And so it sounded like that was a fairly accurate assessment in terms of what you had commented on earlier about Sam.
I'm not sure about dominant force, okay. But definitely from Sam and through Brian, what I heard was, we're going to focus on the Capellan. We've never focused on the Confederation really at all. They've been the Baltic whipping boy for 15 years.
Yep.
We want to start showcasing them, and we want to make them cool, so people actually want to play and be a Confederation faction member, because there really hadn't been much of anything before that time. So it definitely was in the notes to focus on the Confederation, make them cool, make them someone, make them rich, give them some history, give them some culture. And there's that hadn't been done. So I got to create, I really feel like I got to create a faction in BattleTech. I mean, they already existed, but only on the barest, in the barest possible means. The Confederation House book was a nice start, but it seems like that was done, and then nobody looked at that book for like the next 5-10 years, because almost every time they showed up in the novels or something, they were extremely two-dimensional. They had no depth to them at all. So I went back and reread that House book several times and really took it to heart and said, okay, let's take this material. Let's also update it. Let's really make these warehouses a living, breathing, you know, a system of, I guess you'd call them like almost like pseudo religious military organizations. I mean, they have their own culture, their own mythology, their own everything. And, you know, that was my goal in Binding Force, was to bring a warrior house alive.
Yeah.
Double Blind was mostly about just the machinations of how does such a small successor state stay alive? Mm-hmm. And the Confederation was always about Max was supposed to be this brilliant guy that he could twist and turn and keep everyone guessing. And then he went crazy. So I had to do that again and bring Sun Tzu up as a real character to say, how does they stay alive? Because Sun Tzu is really, really good at machinations, and he's completely ruthless. He will do what it takes to make sure his realm survives. So that was Double Blind. I showed that for the first time. That's why I knew at the very end that he was going to basically pull the trigger himself drop the hammer himself on a main character.
Right.
And then Binding Force was to bring a warrior house alive and show the mythology, the culture, and show it from the point of view of an outsider, so I could really dive into what, you know, as an outsider, Eris Sung could showcase all the little stuff. He didn't know anything coming in, except he wanted to belong somewhere. And so he got to learn as he went, which means the reader got to learn as we went. So that's where Binding Force came from. It was just about showcasing this and bringing it alive for really almost the first time ever.
Definitely. And kind of focusing on Double Blind, that also seems to be the first time we really focused on Periphery Faction as well.
Yep.
And so I'm curious, you had mentioned kind of, you know, it sounded like when you were talking about kind of the directives from FASA and kind of where you're placing your story and your timeline, it kind of put it in that kind of pre-Twilight of the Clans. And so, one, I'm really interested in kind of the decisions that led to this story. Certainly for you, you know, being your first novel, and I'm not sure if it was your first novel ever, if it was just your first BattleTech novel, but certainly that first one benefits from the years and years of kind of, you know, musing on what story you want to tell. And I'm curious of kind of how those musings, you know, kind of manifested into that first novel for you, and how the kind of direction from Sam or the other higher ups at FASA in terms of bringing in Liao and Sun Tzu, but also the Periphery and focusing on the magistracy and those characters for the first time, and kind of how exciting was that for you as a fan, and then what were the kind of challenges of kind of developing that within the only story that you wanted to tell?
Double Blind was, I believe, the third full novel I had ever written. I had written two novels before that, just spec novels that never went anywhere. One large, fantasy genre novels. This was my first one writing a big military sci-fi piece. Now, I read a lot of military sci-fi. I was in the military for 5 years in the Navy. Mm-hmm. So I knew how to generate lingo and some of the culture of that. And I read a lot of military science fiction. So that was, you know, always a plus. Like I said, Brian, you know, from Sam's direction, Brian and Sam gave me 6 or 7 bullet points. You know, focus on, you know, bring the Confederation in, make them look cool. Mm-hmm. Talk, you know, hit on a mercenary, you know, hit on mercenary lifestyle of some type, make up a unit, bring in a new one or a one, whatever, they didn't care. They said, we're going to focus on the Periphery in coming source books and novels. So maybe like bring a Periphery nation in if you can, you know, focus on the Periphery a little bit. What else did they say? They talked about Word of Blake, that Word of Blake was up and coming. So, you know, mm-hmm. Word of Blake had to be doing something. So again, they gave me these big, a shotgun of bullet points that none of which connected to each other at that moment. There was no story. And so I had to come up with an idea of, okay, so I've got Word of Blake out in the periphery doing something. I have Sun Tzu, at the time, I was going to send a mercenary unit out to the periphery to do something. And then those storylines would collide. And that's how I would get like all of these different factions involved in what was going on. As it turns out, the mercenary unit was not sent by Sun Tzu. So the Sun Tzu thread became its own. So I ended up with three plot lines. Mm-hmm. The angels coming off of New Home and heading out to the periphery, which is usually, you know, death for mercenaries. Right. But they were, you know, taking that shot. The Sun Tzu political, very short political plot line of him going out to the periphery. Mm-hmm. And then the Word of Blake is also out in the periphery on Astrakhazy, working with the hegemony and Astrakhazy and doing stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And the angels and the Word of Blake kind of came head to head right away, where Sun Tzu's plot line was floating up above it, just showing that there was a bigger umbrella going on. As the big political players are moving around, you go down, you see, you know, the angels are at the front of this particular political wave doing all the fighting. And then you know that there is the Word of Blake thing out there, but the angels, nobody else knows that Word of Blake is doing this. That's something that's uncovered as they go. Yeah. And then they get to Astrakhazy and that all blows up. And then Sun Tzu comes in, I don't tie him into the very, very end, where he comes strutting on stage on a mech to say, "And I, my people, I am here to save you." And then, you know, that's what he does. He can ride it along in the parade. He can't fight. That's where it all tied together at the very end of those battles on Astrakhazy. And then, you know, then Sun Tzu, caps Damona Aziz, I think it was. You can see him tying, he's trying to yoke the Canopians to the Confederation. And while Emma Centrella is a very smart woman and a great leader, she's making, you know, she knows, oh, I can, I'll just milk them for all it's worth. I'm like, yeah, but you're still making a deal with the devil. Yeah. The devil's going to get his due. And eventually, and I was, Sun Tzu was playing a long game at that point. And you could already tell, I think he even mentioned it in the first Sun Tzu chapter, he's not just looking at Canopus, he's looking at the Torii Concordat as well. Yep. That if he could basically, you know, get that all that strength funneled in through his direction, not only will the Confederation survive, he could go on the offensive in places. And that plot line was completely just spun out of whole cloth as I went. And that set a storyline that was moving for, oh my God, I mean, how long did that storyline run? 10 years? We're still dealing with the aftermath. I mean, he broke the Concordat. The Concordat actually kind of like fell apart with Grover Strapland and all that, under the demands of the Confederation and the Trinity Alliance. And so Sun Tzu kind of soaked them dry, brought the Canopians up as a real partner, but always with him able to keep his thumb on the direction it was going to point.
Right.
So that was a very long, I mean, that plot line could have been just a one and done, but because Fasa loved it, they kept bringing that back. And we kept the Canopians involved, the Taurians involved, and we're still telling that story. Even now in the Ill Clan era, the Centrellas and the Laos are still related in by blood in a lot of places. They still work together in a lot of places. They're having some difficulties at the moment. You know, the Canopians are starting to like maybe looking like, hey, should we screw with Lao at this moment? But in the end, you know, family's family, and I wouldn't turn my back on them.
Yeah. The you brought the Word of Blake as a third faction, and I had in my own kind of reread through, I made it up to a Blood of Heroes and skipped ahead to Double Blind to kind of get ready for our conversation. So there might have been stuff I missed there, but it also seemed like that was an early stage of Word of Blake kind of taking the place as Comstar, as kind of that master manipulating faction there. Is, you know, is that right? Was yours the first time where Word of Blake really kind of started to take that place, or was that a thread that had been kind of coming through, and did you guys know where that was going, or was it just kind of set the seed so that we could possibly use it later?
I believe Damona Aziz shows up in a Mike Stackpole novel or two before that moment. So she was already a character on stage, I believe. The 6th of June movement, I think, was mentioned somewhere in a source book, but not much more than that. That there was a movement called the 6th of June based on when, I'm probably get this wrong, was it when Mindo Waterley was assassinated by Anastasius? I might be dropping the names wrong here, but anyway, 6th June was based on that and the idea of assassination as a tool of statecraft. Mm-hmm. Cameron Saint-Germain, I think, was a character I invented completely to be the leader of the 6th of June movement inside of Word of Blake. It's been a long time. I'm pretty sure I'm getting
this right. 25 years.
So some of this was already existing. Some of it I just tacked onto. We knew Word of Blake was going to be coming up, becoming more important. And eventually Word of Blake and Comstar were going to, you know, go head to head. We weren't sure how it was going to look. We just knew it was going to happen. They were going to be a competing Comstar faction, secularism versus spiritual versus the spirit, fake spiritualism, and to see where that went. I moved when I realized later I had to kill Damona Aziz, that someone had to pay the price. You know, someone on the bad guy side had to kind of pay the price for this debacle out in the periphery. I originally really thought it would be Cameron Saint-Germain, and in the end ended up being Damona Aziz, and Cameron was a survivor, mm-hmm. and he went on to become a major political figure, power player in the Inner Sphere, dealing with Catherine and other people, so being able to play at that level. At that point, I was pretty sure Damona Aziz had pretty much risen to the highest she was ever going to rise as a good character. At that point, I thought Cameron had more room to grow and be more interesting. So that's why Damona was the one that eventually they got capped by Sun Tzu. And she had a good scene on the way out, and it was a fun moment between Sun Tzu and Naomi, and continuing the education of Naomi Centrella.
Indeed. You had mentioned kind of the dueling nature of Comstar and Word of Blake, kind of as a yin and yang, and I, and reading that, I saw, and certainly kind of in the settings that you chose, a lot of similarities between kind of a Sunni and Shiite type of, coexistence and kind of friction within the culture, and certainly kind of the setting that you chose, for this book, in kind of a very Middle East type setting, a lot of the tribalistic traditions and culture there. Is that, certainly BattleTech kind of drawing from military history, is that kind of an intentional kind of parallel that you guys have taken through true history, or is that just kind of a, coincidence in terms of the similarities?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. I would say that would be a question of Mike Stackpole, who is I believe he is a major in history. He's had a degree in history. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't surprise me at all that Mike was doing all that intentionally. I mean, in the end, Comstar was a pseudo-religious faction, mm-hmm. with a secular uprising. And when that happens, you always get conflict. You get heresies and splinter groups and all this other stuff that happens. History is resplendent with many, many examples. What was Mike's inspiration for that, and Fast's inspiration? Because I'm sure it was done. I'm sure this was not just Mike. I'm sure it was Mike and Brian and Sam in a meeting somewhere.
Yeah.
In a creative summit, talking about how they're going to split Comstar up and Comstar Word of Blake. That was probably, designed. But what his model was, it wouldn't surprise me, because he is a student of history. When I got it, it was already it was already on the path. So I was already told, this is who Word of Blake is, this is who Comstar is, just keep it going. And then the Astrakazi overlay was just completely random happenstance. I looked at some of the worlds that the final battle could have been on, looking for a fun place to explore. I found Astrakazi, and I'm not sure, one of the periphery Star Corps source books somewhere. And so I was like, right out of Tales of the what was it? The Arabian Nights tales, you know, Tales of Arabian Nights. Like that's all I knew about Astrakhazi. It was very kind of Middle Eastern, Arabian Nights, and that's what I had to work with. Everything else, I just kind of went from there and invented as I went and tried to come up with like some of these older Arabian tropes, like the whirling dervishes, the opulent pasha, shah, vizier kind of like lifestyle, the remnants in the desert who are always with their little ideas of like someday we will inherit the world, but meanwhile we're just trying to survive. And I just threw all that together and just kind of into a big bag and shook it up to see what would come out. So any parallels and other things that happen in there about is just completely by accident.
And I think one of the parts of that book that I enjoyed the most was your descriptions of the mounted horsemen and kind of, you know, combining that in infantry and mech tactics. Was that inspiration from various gameplay that you had done, or a particular interest in kind of the relationship between infantry and mechs? Because that theme did continue into Binding Force, which we'll talk on when we get there.
When I broke the angels and they went and they got scattered in the desert and they met the desert tribes, I had a vague idea the desert tribes would keep them alive and help them get back on their feet. As I invented the culture of these desert tribes out there, and it was just kind of came as I was writing, at that point I saw the final battle. I knew I was going to have these tribal warriors on horseback charging the field. And I had to make sure that, first of all, you would believe that they're crazy enough to do it, or they believe enough to do it. And I had to give them the chance to win. So they had, they already had enough native talent, and they were taught enough that they could literally ride horses against battle mechs and take some down, with swarming techniques. Battle mechs have always been, but battles have always been susceptible to infantry swarm techniques. But just the idea of a few mechs and this cavalry charge. I just thought this is something. It's right out of like Lawrence of Arabia kind of stuff. Like this whole thing where they're charging these superhuman, supersized walking tanks. Like this is going to look cool. And it's going to be a bloodbath. Both. But it made for a very awesome way to bring, again, all these stories suddenly just come together in one moment. And that may be just one of the scenes, even today, is one of my top, like I say, five favorite scenes I have ever written for BattleTech. That is definitely one of them. And even today, people talk to me about that scene all the time. How it came together, how it was written, So I think I wrote something there that just is going to last because it's just, people keep bringing it up, 15, 20 years later, 20 years later.
It's 25, Lauren, not
25 years later. I don't know how old I
am. So moving on to Binding Force, first talk to me a little bit about kind of from a broader view, what you learned writing that first book and how you leveraged that into Binding Force. Because having read them, like I could see the evolution of you as a writer, and it may have just been the story, in terms of how it flowed, but Binding Force, just there was a much, much more cohesive flow, whereas I felt like Double Line, there were a lot of very interesting points. Hello, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that first part of my conversation with Lauren. There is an extended version of that available exclusively for patrons over at patreon.com/renegadehbg. We dive into Binding Force for that second part. Really fun. I'm really glad I got to read that novel kind of in preparation for this podcast because it's probably about 10 novels ahead of where I'm at now with my read through. And we just had a blast with it. And I wanted to kind of do something special for the people that support this channel. And as a little carrot for those of you that don't quite support, it's just $1 a month at the lowest tier to support the channel. And I think I'm going to start doing this for some of my podcasts, maybe take about a quarter of the total conversations and make an exclusive for those patrons. Maybe not forever, maybe for a year or so. Definitely I wanted to give back a little to the people that support and encourage others to do so as well, because the more support I get, the the more I can do. It's easier to justify taking a day or two off work to produce, to record, to edit with that support. And the more support I have, the more I can produce. So yeah. And even if you don't, there's a full second part of this conversation. I'm going to pop it up in a link here. I'm not sure which side it will pop up on, but in that about 70-80 minutes continuation of the conversation, we dive into Lauren's role as owner CEO of Catalyst Game Labs. And so a lot of fun there, a lot of fun topics, some hard topics. You know, we don't kind of hold punches there, but it was a really good conversation, and I encourage you to check it out. Thanks again. We'll catch you on the next podcast. Mm-hmm.